Welcome to ASEAN New Horizons, where law enforcement practitioners and academics get together to share knowledge and ideas to shape the future of crime analysis.
My name is Cliff Aguiar, and I'm a criminal intelligence analyst with the South Simcoe Police Service currently. I'm also a professor at the Seneca College in the Bachelor of Crime and Criminal Intelligence Analysis degree, which I was part of building and creating for the college probably in the last 7 years, but we went live with the program 2 years ago. So we're beginning to see our cohort of our students graduating for the first time this year. In addition to that, I was and started my career really as a fraud investigator many years ago, working in finances and doing fraud investigations through skimming and some of the early sensibilities around fraud, and then moved my way into the crime analyst role with York Regional Police. And there I was largely tactical, so working in a division or district where I worked primarily with property crimes and crimes against persons, and sort of moved around quite a bit in the York Regional Police Service, having then spent a good portion of time in one of the larger, busier areas of York. Again, working with property crimes and you know, attempt murder investigations, break-and-enters, theft from vehicles, theft of vehicles, you name it, we did it. And then largely that was sort of the beginning of piecing together some organized crime intelligence analysis pieces, which actually brought me to moving into the intelligence unit at York Regional Police, where I worked with primarily Eastern European organized crime, but was sort of used as like a project analyst, where I'd go off to another service area, such as frauds or drugs and vice, human trafficking. And so I'd spend time doing projects within the service. I was then relegated to creating the real-time operations center at York Regional Police. And really what we're looking for was, you know, giving analysis to officers in real time and structuring an opportunity for officers to have access to an analyst 24/7, given the way that crime obviously doesn't stop during an analyst role of 7 to 3.
I have done a lot.
I think part of that was, you know, doing the intelligence piece, doing the real-time operations center, and then moving to the provincial side, where I created the provincial operations center from a crime analysis perspective for the OPP. And then during that time frame is when we were building the degree program at Seneca College, and then I was able to teach that on a full-time basis while creating relationships with services that we really didn't have access to crime analysis, like the South Central Police Service, and then structuring a position and role for that service as it grows, which is where we stand today. And in between, I've done projects for the Ministry of Attorney General, where I've acted as an investigator for the ministry and the province, and then most recently working for the Chief Coroner's Office in Ontario for the Thunder Bay Police investigation or reinvestigation called Broken Trust, which the report should be due in the next month or so.
I mean, I'm hoping we'd be able to get sort of here in the UK the report so we can read it ourselves. But Cliff, I'm going to have to ask, how much can you tell us about the Thunder Bay investigation for those that don't know what it is here in the UK?
Sure. It's a bit complex. I think the Thunder Bay Police Service is Thunder Bay is a, you know, very small location. It's a northern location in Ontario. The population of Thunder Bay is rich in history with members of the Indigenous community. And then, of course, you know, the blended sort of population of Thunder Bay, which is largely Caucasian. But and so you have historically some, and certainly what's been reported is that there were some issues between the Indigenous community and both the policing community and the citizens. And so these complaints came forward a few years ago. Actually, while I was in the Ministry of Attorney General's office acting as an investigator, we got the complaint in from members of the public who had indicated that some of the investigations around missing persons specifically, and only really to the Indigenous population, were not handled or investigated to the fulsome nature that wasn't expected, you know, from a public's perspective and certainly from an investigative perspective. So that complaint went to the ministry, which is called the Office of the Independent Police Review Director, or the OIPRD, who undertook a few years to reinvestigate some of the files. As a result of that, there was a call for a reinvestigation of those 9 cases which had been identified. There were more, but 9 specific cases had been identified by the OIPRD to be reopened and have another look at to see whether or not the police service had actually conducted the investigation that was necessary. And again, most of it related to sudden deaths. So people who were found in the waterways within the Thunder Bay area. And some of the questions they were asking, you know, were the investigations prejudicial to some of the stereotypes that people have about Indigenous persons? In other words, relegated to falling into the water as a result of consuming alcohol. And so it was, in many cases, the complaints were there wasn't enough attention or enough resources, or the breadth of the investigation was dissimilar to investigations that would be conducted traditionally for non-Indigenous people within the Thunder Bay area. The report was out. It was called Broken Trust. It was released a number of years ago and effectively outlined where some of the investigations failed. In tandem with that, there was some acknowledgement by the Thunder Bay Police Chief that systemic racism related to the Indigenous population was in fact alive and well recognized by the service. There were two factors that were at play. One, sort of the internal realization that there was some issues in relation to systemic racism towards Indigenous people, and the fact that some of the investigations were potentially lacking in fulsomeness. So as a result of that, the coroner's office began identifying a team of people to come forward to reopen those 9 cases. I happened to be contacted by the commissioner of the OPP, who had indicated they were looking for a crime analyst and had put my name forward. So I worked with a couple of Thunder Bay investigators who were part of the team, and then some external officers that were brought in from the OPP, from Treaty 3 First Nations Policing, and the Anishinaabe Ashiki Police Service, or what we call NAPS. And I was asked to be their analyst for those projects. And that included looking at as we cracked open the cases, looking at how historically they utilized analysis and whether they did, and how we could use crime analysis for charting, for linkage background checks, for visual pieces, social media open source, a sort of blended approach to an investigation that you would typically see in a contemporary investigation around either a missing person or someone who has died suddenly or unexpectedly, even at the hands of waterways.
So interesting. So interesting to hear about. How did you find it as being an analyst as part of that investigation? Was it different to other investigations you've conducted?
It's a great question. And my mind turns to the fact that it was a very difficult investigation to be part of, I think largely because you have an acknowledgement. And for my teaching at Seneca College, one of the courses that I teach is Diversity and Indigenous Peoples of Canada. And so I'm cognizant of the history of the Indigenous people in Canada, and I'm cognizant of where we're at, both historically and contemporarily, with the recent discovery of unmarked graves for children who are at residential schools in Canada. So we're sort of living and breathing this historic movement towards understanding that, you know, the history has been unkind to the people of the Indigenous people of Canada. And so when you open up these investigations, you know, you largely are doing so because there's obviously been some criticism of that investigation. As an analyst, you get to be, you know, prolifically anyway, and certainly how I see the role is you are embedded as though you are an investigator, like an investigative analyst. You are there to support, to be part of the idea process, to open new ideas, to suggest ideas, to be critical of the things that, you know, potentially weren't done well, and even both historically and during the investigation. So part of the role is not just sitting back and being administrative, as many people see their analyst role. It's being an active participant in structuring ideas, creating charts, visual pieces, so that we could see information displayed in a way that was meaningful. So it was challenging. It was challenging because there was a lot of information. There's a lot of data to be read. There's also a disconnect between, which I think we'll talk about in a second, which is the disconnect between different agencies in terms of data acquisition and sharing, both from a technological and an ideological perspective. So there are some frustrations that are live and well, which I have noted in that final report. But on a positive side, you know, the role of the analyst for myself was critical because it, you know, I was doing this for the people of Thunder Bay and doing this for the Indigenous population that needed and were, they deserved, but it's the wrong term, but they did deserve that sort of fulsome review, right? And, you know, giving the perspective, the global perspective, not only about those investigations, but what was going on globally within the Thunder Bay Police Service, and external and internal and information flow and access to technology. So my role was really built upon and perpetuated on the idea that I owe it to not only the people of Thunder Bay, the Thunder Bay Police Service, but also to the Indigenous population to provide the most fulsome analysis and access to information. Whether the positive, it ended up being a positive or negative outcome, it was not relevant to me. It was more that we provided the kind of analytical expertise that we needed to.
Absolutely. That's really important. And, you know, you mentioned, you briefly touched on the issues around, you know, silos and information sharing. Let's talk about them because they're issues that we have here in the UK as well. So it'd be good to sort of, our listeners sort of compare those to the UK and also sort of Canada. So if you could, Cliff, could you describe them a little bit more?
The silos themselves are, it is, for anyone that knows me in this industry, they know that that is my hot button in terms of the challenges that we see in this province and across Canada. To start, I will say that we have identified as an agency being criminal justice and crime analysis in general, that access to information is a problem. And that has been identified in a number of reviews over the years, including for those who are Google ready, the Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka investigation, which was probably about 25 or 30 years ago. And in that reinvestigation, they were a serial killer couple. It was identified in the Archie Campbell review that the police services had this process, this ideological process in place, that the sharing of information was something that wasn't done readily. And that was both back then, of course, technological, but also, as I mentioned earlier, ideological, in that there's this mind principle that, you know, this is my investigation. I don't want to give up too much information. It could risk it. And so there's this perception that lives in policing in Ontario, and certainly in Canada, I would suspect that's my purview, that there's a fear around the double-edged sword of providing information that it may either, you know, mess up the investigation or somebody might steal the information. And so that leads to this lack of sharing of information from one police service to the next. And so Ontario is no different than most. There's jurisdictions in terms of police services boundaries based on cities here. We have several in Ontario, but with Ontario, what we have are a number of different records management systems that don't actually speak to one another. So we have a Versedex, which is used by larger services. And then we have a niche platform, which is used by some of the smaller services or the OPP. And so with the niche services, you have some agencies that are on one network, and then you have other agencies that are on another network. So what that means is that if I want to run or do a background check on Cliff Aguiar, I can run my name on the system and I can do a check sort of at a national or provincial scale and get a return. But you also have a lot of police services in this province that don't actually contribute at all. They're sort of an independent standalone system. And so their reports don't actually show up. In addition, you know, as an analyst, as you can appreciate, Paige, some of our work is partial information, running phone numbers, running partial addresses, running partial names, and having the ability to overlay that information as you're doing your work, whether it's a phone tone analysis, whether it's a background search on someone, we can't physically do that in Canada. So I can't run a phone number and provide us with, all the services that exist in Ontario. I'd actually have to send an email to analysts from various different agencies and say, hey, can you run this phone number? And of course, that's problematic on a number of fronts. One, there's always a lag. The, you know, analytical lag is a problem because by the time you're sending an email out to get information, you move on and you do other stuff, and then you might forget why you ran that phone number, or the timeliness of it could be problematic to your investigation or could be a critical piece of that. And so from email to email, that's how people are communicating in that silo process. That's just technological, right? What we saw in British Columbia was when Robert Picton, the serial killer out in BC, had been targeting largely women who were in the sex trade and who were of Indigenous background. That review and reinvestigation of the work that the BC police had done at the time, the Vancouver police and surrounding police services, was again the same issues. The services were disparate. There wasn't access to information. They weren't sharing information between each other. The analysts weren't engaged in a way to send bulletins and bolos out, just part of the investigation. What BC did, though, is they created BC Prime, which effectively mandated that all agencies, small or large, in the province needed to contribute to one records management system. So now Vancouver PD analysts, when they query a phone number or partial name or partial phone number, it actually runs it across all provincial police services in that province. You can imagine how amazing that is. We'd like to see that in Ontario. And that was one of the recommendations that I had made in the Thunder Bay report, is that we look at structuring an Ontario Connect platform, which brings us together in one central location for access to information. And if I could, I would actually argue that we should be doing that on a national level. So in other words, being able to link, you know, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Newfoundland, Halifax, all of these provinces that have police services and records management systems should ideally, and I don't think it's a stretch given our technological advances today, that we should be able to link all the service together into one platform. So that's really what the silos that, and they become perpetuated. I think the fear and the danger, more so the danger, is that people live and breathe the expectation that that's just the way it is. And it is unacceptable, I think, today. What we, crime solvability and the prevention of serial killers like Bruce MacArthur, who targeted the gay community in Toronto, again, is predicated and underpinned by the fact that people don't share information, or we become blind to the fact that perhaps there's some other cultural aspects, as was seen in the Bruce MacArthur investigation, as was seen in the missing and murdered women investigation for British Columbia and other investigations, that if we don't provide access to information to investigators and to analysts, that we end up in the same situation that we were 30 years ago, and that people die at the hands of that lack of sharing. And I don't think the public certainly expects that. In fact, I think the public is of the opinion that we that we are interconnected. So I think the shock to the system would be more so that we're not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just rather frustrating because we always have a lot of information, and most of the time it doesn't get shared effectively or efficiently on time. Well, like you said, when you need it, and then you sort of move on to other cases. Cliff, I remember you saying that you are a director at the moment of an association. How does that link with the whole sharing information silos?
Yeah, so I didn't mention that in the introduction, but certainly one of the things that I took on a couple of years ago was becoming the director of the Ontario Crime Analysis Network, so OCAN for short. And when I was asked to take it over, I was cognizant of the fact that you know, people are often critical of my big thinking and my progression. I'm constantly taken to task at how progressive my thoughts are in relation to how slowly police moves, but you know, I will not allow that to become a challenge for me to actually put out ideas. I think for the most part, the reason why OCAN is becoming even more successful today is because people want access to ideologies that are big thinkers, big ideas, access to sharing that information. So part of the role that I have now at OCAN with my executive team is to start to come together, both to provide training to analysts in this province for consistency and standardization in terms of how we do our work, and also to discuss the evolution of technology and the evolution of the analytical role. It changes how we have access to data, how the market, in other words, how the criminal market changes, also has to be in flow with how analysis works. And so OCAN strives to provide not only training, but also ideological platform and opportunities to connect with analysts indirectly and directly. It also allows me to connect with the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police, or the OACP, on strategizing for future training, future ideas, and future projects. So some of the tasks that we have right now with OCAN is connecting analysts together. And one of the projects that we've taken on and have been successful in doing is connecting the different services across Canada. So it used to be that we'd have a distribution list for analysts in the province. We've now expanded and connected with the Vancouver Police Department, for example, Regina, Saskatoon, Calgary, Edmonton, Halifax. And so we are effectively putting all of the analysts in Canada into one database that's accessible by anyone across Canada. So if you're looking for an analyst in Vancouver, here's the list. If you're looking for an analyst in, you know, a city of Richmond Hill, here's the analyst. If you're looking for someone in the northern parts of Thunder Bay or, Nipissing, then you have access to that information. So that breaks down the silos. And part of what we're talking about is sitting back thinking, well, who do I ask for this information? Because technically, from a technological perspective, I can't search it. So that's what OCAN strives to do, is to break down those barriers. We're also working with the Central Intelligence Services of Ontario, or the CISO, in formulating a mechanism and technological mechanism to share information provincially through one system. So those bulletins and those be on the lookouts or the BOLOs that we all get, you know, they're sort of scattered based on who they think should get access to that information. And you and I both know that we send out bulletins and BOLOs to who we think the audience should be. And that in some cases can be detrimental. I'll give you an example. Yesterday I got a bulletin from a colleague who works just over the border here to me, and she forwarded a bulletin from another area of the province. When I opened it, I realized that I had known who the suspects were because they had hit us. But the other agency side, so the more northern agency that forwarded that internally, didn't send it to me. And because they probably thought, well, they're not going to hit that area where Cliff works because, you know, it's probably a stretch. The reality is they did. And so we become accustomed to, again, that information silo, the breakdown, the sharing of information is predicated on what we think ideologically should be. So the CISO and OCAN are trying to strategize in a way to create a database and or a network server where you would submit your bulletin or BOLO, identify the geographic location you're in, and that system would self-generate bulletins and BOLOs out to the analysts just based on the input. And it also becomes a repository so that if you ever had a crime and you needed to go back to and do a search, you could actually go into that system and search it. And everyone becomes unified. We all have one-stop shop for access to information.
Would you like to come and develop a system like that here in the UK?
Sure. I would love to. In the utopian world of my head, and again, this is where I get kicked down quite a bit, is, we're living in 2021 where these ideas are not technologically out of our realm. If it were me, we would have a national database and an international database where you could submit all of your data in one place and then, you know, do a search or query, and it would run bulletins and BOLOs across the world. We know that, and Paige, this is not uncommon to you or I or to anyone in analytics, people move. You know, people are transient, especially in the criminal market. And just because, we're in Canada, doesn't mean that they haven't gone over to the UK to commit the crimes either. So in my sort of dystopian, utopian world, If it were me, especially in Ontario, Canada, I would create sort of like the super analyst role within a command center, where the role and responsibilities of those analysts would be to look at the data nationally, certainly provincially, and see where the connections are on that national scale, as opposed to that sort of microscopic municipal small service or that one area perspective.
Absolutely. Let's touch on that. So we had a really good conversation before about the analyst role, where sort of we are, where we're going. And we briefly touched on, in sort of an informal conversation, the differences between, you know, UK analysts here and analysts out in Canada. What do you think, from your experience, where we are at the moment with analysts? Is there things that need to be done, or are we where we need to be?
Definitely not where we need to be. The one thing, and I don't know if this is the same in the UK as it is here, but we often see a very distinct break between civilian analysts and uniform officers in terms of the role. I think it's subjectively the way it's always been. I think subconsciously it's been perpetuated in that, you know, it's a civilian, and often that civilian role, or the mindset of the role, is given less sort of credence, because there's this ideology that, well, they're a civilian, they want to understand police work. They're a civilian, they're a risk in terms of it going to court. They're a civilian, and so they don't understand an investigation because they've never been out on the road, they've never put handcuffs on someone, and they've never gone to put together a brief, all those kinds of caveats that we see. And it's alive and well, certainly from my perspective. I can tell you that I experience that all the time, both from the tactical side, but also from the strategic intelligence world, where there's a fear around giving me information when it comes to intelligence, because there's a perception that I won't know how to handle it. And because of that, it creates, again, back the same conversation we had before, it creates silos, it creates a lack of shared information. People hold on to their cards because they think if they hold on to it, it's much more effective than it is by sharing. And that in and of itself is problematic and needs to be broken down. Now, I get it. There are some analysts that, you know, maybe they're not, this isn't their destiny. But for the most part, if you're in the police service and you're working within a police service, you're given the same clearance rates and clearance from a police officer. And so my expectation is that you be treated as though you have the same access and background checks that anyone else has had in the service. The other side, of course, is that the analyst role is, in fact, evolving. In Canada, certainly what we're starting to see in Ontario is that we're becoming more investigative analysts than we are crime analysts. In other words, we investigate crime. And there needs to be an acceptance within policing, both from the association level and from the uniform and from management, that analysts can investigate. That means I can, you know, source video, I can look at video, I can put together bulletins, I can identify people, I can put together a brief, I can put together a linkage chart, I can provide the evidence in a document, which we do now. Many of us put together intelligence reports, production analysis reports that often go to our defense and crown as evidence. So we're doing the work. The challenge is that we see a lot of resistance to the civilianization of investigative work. And the reality is that, you know, it's harder and harder to find people to get into policing. It's difficult now to utilize the resources that we have as a result of the complexity of investigations that have become even more complex now, with fraud investigations, Beanie investigations, the evolution of criminality in terms of using technology differently. So then you may have a drop in calls for service globally, as an example, but the complexity of each case and the evidence required for that has gone even higher. So we're now relying on the same number of bodies in terms of police officers for much more complex and much more evidence-driven investigations. For me, what I'm pushing in this province, and we've started to see some movement in the OPP, or the Ontario Provincial Police, is the movement towards investigative analysts. And that means that you not only sit at a chair and do investigative work, but you can go out and source interviews, you can go out and grab evidence in terms of videos and come back, review it, put together, make case linkages, and continue to still do the analytical role in terms of reading your calls for service, looking at hotspots, understanding who's committing the crime, but becoming more investigative in practice. And then if you have a case that needs to be turned over to either, you know, a special constable, or the analyst becomes a special constable, or you turn it over to a uniform officer to make the arrest, that inertia has to happen in this industry. And there's some pressure for that as well, because, you know, analysts also have to evolve, and analysts want to become better at their role and become more prolific in their role as we move forward. So it doesn't mean everyone has to become an investigative analyst. I think you could probably have a tiered system where you have investigative analysts who are the go-getters and understand and have the training and knowledge of the investigative and court process. And then you have the analysts that live and breathe in the traditional roles of tactical, strategic intelligence, and, you know, perhaps tier it to operation centers and whatnot.
This is something I think could easily roll out here in the UK, you know, bringing the analysts, to be honest with you, they are, you know, an important individual during any investigation. They know the data. Therefore, it's only logical that they sort of push that forward and sitting on other meetings and be there when, you know, the discussions are happening of what's going to happen next in terms of action, etc. So I think, Cliff, I think you should move to the UK for a bit and just help out over here.
Well, you tell me, like, what's it like there? Is there an inertia to move towards that, or is it still relegated to sort of the traditional role?
With some of, if I base it on some of the research that I've done thus far in this field, analysts are still undermined in terms of what they can achieve and where they're sort of placed in our police forces. Now, people that listen to this might disagree with that, but that's me basing on a lot of interviews that I've conducted with those individuals, which I don't know, Cliff, does that surprise you? Does it surprise you that analysts are undermined, or is that something you can relate to?
No, I think it's very common, actually, in my experience in speaking to a lot of people and having, I mean, in my own experience, it has been like that for years and continues to be that. And, you know, again, I think there's a fear in terms of, and maybe it's two part. And I think part of it is that when you have somebody who's completely engaged and smart, intellectual, understands the process, it can also be a threat to those in the industry who aren't at that level as uniform officers. And so you become this sort of threat to their, how they're perceived, how, where I think my experience for people who are engaged and want analysts to grow are the ones that think prolifically about the, that the analyst role and the investigative role is actually a collaboration, and it makes the service look good. It makes the officer look good. It makes the analyst look good. And ultimately that's what it's about. And to me, you know, when I speak to the Thunder Bay investigation, or I speak to, or I read the reports about Bruce MacArthur and missing persons, or the BC investigation in particular, what I say is we are accountable to the public, and the public is ultimately my customer, because they are the ones that fund me, quite frankly. And secondly, they have an expectation that I perform to the level that they would expect. And so there's this incongruency, I think, that, you know, these television shows that exist both in the UK and Canada, that, you know, a crime does this and analysts do this and you have access to this, and then you get into the role and the reality is you don't. And so the public thinks we do. And I think that, as I mentioned earlier, the collective shock I found really when you talk to the public is then they realize you don't. And so by pushing the envelope, as we do with OCAN, as we do with CISO, and do with the analysts in this province, what we're saying is we need to evolve and we need to be part of the investigative process. I have a hard, fast rule. I've told every investigator when I've started a case, and I said, I need to be part of the investigation from the beginning, not the middle, not the end when you need it. It's from the beginning. If it doesn't happen, I want nothing to do with it. Because you can't be part of an investigation and be brought in with partial information where they don't share their whole back and whatnot. That needs to end. And I think part of the investigative role that the OPP is seeing is, you know, why can't we have an analyst go out and sit down with someone and gather information and utilize that information as part of their intelligence report or as part of their tactical investigation that they can turn over to someone to effect the arrest? There's nothing prolifically going to happen as long as you train and provide the leadership and guidance that we all seek to have in this role. And that's where I see my role as OCAN is providing that overarching innovation perspective for the province, and then liaising with the people that make the decisions, both at the OACP and otherwise, to facilitate a movement, both technological and ideological, towards that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right. They need to be there at the beginning, which most of the time, you know, most of the time, I hope they are. But after they've given the data away, that's it. They don't know the outcome of that investigation. That's quite sad. I think I mentioned that on another podcast I did recently, where I said it's quite a sad, you know, situation to be in, because they are so important. I think if this podcast was live, Cliff, we'd have so many analysts sort of maybe agreeing with you with what you're saying, but some of them just might not have the confidence to say it. So I think once this podcast goes live, I think you're probably going to get a lot of messages to sort of say thanks for, you know, speaking out about it, because it's weird. Analysts don't usually talk about their experiences as being an analyst. They're very good at talking about what they do, but they're not that good at talking about what they're experiencing, if you get what I mean.
I do. And I think part of that is because we've relegated ourselves to being seen as less than the investigators and less than the investigative role, as opposed to seeing ourselves as parallel to, if not part of, and if not the lead of, an investigation, right? The many cases where an investigation goes is driven by analytics. And so we need to change the way we think about analysts as not people that are pushing data. We're not administrators. We're not, report writers, and we're not your assistants. Like, our role is to be a criminal intelligence analyst, which means that we are part of the investigative process. We should be part of the decision making. There should be no secret doors closed while they're reviewing the data. And if you don't have the trust in that person, then that's something that you need to take internally and deal with. But to create a process that drives that entire analytical movement based on your perceptions is not good. And so I think that's where, with OCAN, and really, like, as I said, you know, I have big shoulders, and I'm consistently met with these challenges when it comes to management and how they perceive you, and you know, if you act in a way of leadership, it's kind of fearful because they're not sure how to deal with it. But my perspective is, you have to understand that we are, I don't have a badge, I don't have a handcuffs, and I'm certainly never going to have a weapon to arrest people, but I don't need to do that. I can live vicariously through crime solvability behind a desk and a computer screen. I'm happy to do that, but understand that we need to evolve as well. We need to grow, and we need to be part of the challenges that are being met by the industry in general, which is, you know, lack of resources, lack of time, lack of money, whatever else you can throw at the table in terms of the challenges that we see in this industry, but to efficiently use them with the people that know the job, know the business, and know what analytics means.
Exactly. What a way to end this podcast. I really enjoy speaking with you. I really have. I really appreciate you setting time aside to come on the podcast. I know you're very busy with what you're doing currently, but thank you so much, Cliff. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure is mine. Thanks again, Paige. And as I mentioned, if you ever need, I always could use an excuse to go over to the UK. So I'm happy to come over at any point and have those discussions. But thank you again for your time. We do appreciate it.
And now let's get to this episode's science snippets for analysis with me, Suzanne Knabe-Nicole from Police Science Doctor, allocating resources to the highest risk locations. Police analysts can map where the highest risks of a knife-enabled homicide are based on the locations of non-fatal knife incidents. You'll find the link to the original article in this episode's show notes.